I would like to introduce Ms. Nomzamo Zondo, who is the Executive Director of the Socioeconomic Rights Institute of South Africa, SERI. Prior to taking up the position of Executive Director, Nomzamo served as SERI's Director of Litigation. She joined the organization as an attorney in 2013 because she was attracted to the opportunity of working with exploited communities while using the law to balance the scales of social justice. Nomzamo works mainly on cases related to the right to housing, defending communities threatened with eviction, and litigating for the provision of basic services in and the upgrading of informal settlements. In this role, Nomzamo played a key role representing the families and minors involved in the Marikana massacre and defending the social movements and community-based organizations fighting to secure adequate housing and informal traders and informal workers fighting for the right to earn a living. As Director of Litigation at SERI, she has led SERI's litigation unit to numerous groundbreaking victories. Nomzamo holds an LLB degree from the University of the Witwatersrand and served her articles of clerkship with the Wits Law Center. We are honored to have Nomzamo on our panel, and I would like Nomzamo to share with us her reflections.
Shanil, I just want to firstly thank you for the introduction and for your opening words. They were very insightful and they provoked some further thoughts for me. So I work at SERI, which has been involved in work around socioeconomic rights for 10 years. Most of that work has been around the provision of basic services in communities that are living in the inner city of Johannesburg and many informal settlements across the country. The work has also included work to facilitate the participation of informal workers in the economy, the protection of precarious workers, and mainly to ensure the involvement of ordinary South Africans in our political space, especially in as far as they're claiming their socioeconomic rights. And something happened with the announcement of the state of disaster, something that hadn't happened in the 10 years of our work. We have been working with government, at times collaborating, but at times litigating against them to enforce socioeconomic rights. And throughout this time, it's been a battle to convince government about how important these rights are beyond just simply being the provision of those basic necessities. And this crisis brought to the forefront why they are so important. And we had a political will from government to address some of these very, very crucial issues. One of the biggest things that happened was the provision of 41,000 water tanks to communities who have been struggling for water for many years and have been reaching out through different methods to government and civil society, sometimes without any success. There was a moratorium placed on evictions, and there was also a commitment by municipalities to ensure the provision of water and sanitation, some of them finding money that they couldn't find for years to make sure the water tanks were filled. The city of Johannesburg, as an example, made a commitment not to disconnect any further services, and in practice were actively reconnecting households, buildings, and communities who didn't have access to water. And all of this, I remember, just brought this relief of, yes, this is my home. Yes, this is my country. And it brought a new hope about a government that is governing in the interest of its people. It brought back the social contract. And at that time, we also saw moves to listen to complaints. So once the government was acting, people were making suggestions, there was some criticism, but government acted, sometimes slowly, but they acted to respond to the suggestions that were coming around the inclusion of informal traders in the provision of food as an essential service, in the position of waste reclaimers, in the provision of a waste management service in the country. And all of this brought a lot of hope about not just the South Africa that we have now during a crisis, but of the potential that we have post-crisis. I think one of the very crucial moments was the formation of the COVID-19 People's Coalition, which started with a program of action, which identified as critical the firstly self-organization of communities and local action. The program of action immediately invited government to work alongside civil society, understanding that a crisis of this magnitude cannot only be addressed by government with the resources that it has, but it must be able to pull on the resources that we have as all South Africans to ensure that there is compliance, first with the national lockdown, but also that everybody in our society is able to have access to all their basic needs. And one of the disappointments and one of the missed opportunities of this crisis was the government's failure to respond openly to that invitation. While we saw in some departments like the Department of Human Settlements an approach firstly to include social movements working around informal settlements to bring in practitioners, but in general government wanted to think alone around the problems that we were all facing. I think what the crisis did, as Professor Phakeng pointed out, it made clear that we are all in this together. But the door wasn't open to civil society. Some of the very concrete suggestions made by civil society were ignored about ensuring that there is a civil society participation in the National Command Council. And even as we speak now, we've seen a very slow move to include civil society in the work that the government is doing. And I think this has taken us back, but also it's meant that we have not responded as efficiently as we could have during this crisis. And so one of the things that you've seen though from civil society is that even in the face of that, you have seen movements, community-based organizations taking action to support what is a crisis for all of us. Not just the elite, not just government. It's a crisis that's been worsely felt by those who are poorest in our society. So we have seen through the work of the C19 People's Coalition, the facilitation of food distribution, the facilitation of popular education to ensure that our citizens are complying with the national lockdown, to ensure that citizens are obeying the instruction to keep all of us safe. And it has been those initiatives that government could have leveraged, even in instances like the reopening of schools, that we already have thousands of activists who are available to the state, who are aware of the different circumstances of each community, who can be a readily available resource to ensure that firstly, if we do reopen schools, we have the resources to ensure that we minimize transmission. One of the things that has been very important for SARI and I think for many South Africans is the provision of basic services and the fact that our failure to ensure that provision in informal settlements has put us in a very peculiar vulnerability to the transmission of the disease. We have in some instances informal settlements of 7,000 households that share two communal taps. And it's been important for the government to be able to access data that civil society through non-government organization, through practitioners, and sometimes through social movements have collected about the level of service that they have in each community. So we have had data that is sitting in different pockets. It is for government to come in and draw on those resources to make sure that we have the data to address the problems that we're dealing with. We have seen how that has helped in the informal settlement space through the Asibikelane initiative, where we see over 165 informal settlements collating data about the provision of their services, monitoring what's been the response of their municipality to show which municipalities are actually responding effectively and also showing where the biggest threats are coming from. If we are able to collaborate as government, as business, as civil society to ensure that we bring our resources to make sure that at the end of this crisis, the country is better off, I think we would all benefit. At most, we have had a government that's been willing to respond to suggestions, that's been willing to engage, but we remain, and I think civil society remains, as spectators in a crisis that actually needs all hands on deck. And I think it remains the call of civil society that government must come to the table and we're willing to work together to address these very, very difficult circumstances. One of the main issues that SARI has been engaging around the issue has been the policing of the lockdown. Coming from an environment where we've had very poor accountability in cases of police brutality. The lockdown brought into that mix the South African National Defence Force, and again for the first few weeks, the country was aghast with stories of brutality and violence from the security forces, and already within the first 2 weeks of the lockdown, we had two deaths, which came as a result of the enforcement of the lockdown. We've had problems in relation to the use of arrest as a means of getting people not to breach the lockdown. But the main challenge, I think, has been this issue of police and army brutality. And this all came to a head when Mr. Khoza's family took the Ministry of Police, the Minister of Defense, and the presidency to court to say, we need to find a way to enforce the lockdown, which takes into account the human rights of the citizens and a way that treats citizens understanding their rights and also protecting them. And the main challenge has been the response of the leadership, starting from the ministry to the senior management team within the SANDF and the Ministry of Police. And unfortunately, the president, who has been lauded across the globe for having openly communicated with South Africans, for having clarified issues about our COVID response, has really failed to intervene on this space around how we can enforce a lockdown that is respectful of all of our citizens. And I think this all came to a head at the beginning of this week when the South African National Defence Force filed an affidavit in the courts explaining what they've done to comply to a judgment that was given by Fabricius around the issue of the Khoza family and around the enforcement of the lockdown. And the main concern with that was that it was clear that the Ministry of Defence was complying for the sake of compliance. Even worse, what we saw happening was that the Ministry of Defence has and continues to take a position that the army members who killed Mr. Khoza were acting in self-defence. In fact, most offensive is the code of conduct that has been issued for the army in the duration of this operation, which says at every step that in each scenario, the army have an inherent right of self-defense. And I think what makes it even worse is that the army specifically pulls out the incident of Mr. Khoza, which says if you see a glass of alcohol inside a yard, you have a right of self-defense. And what that says to us is that the army has chosen to close ranks instead of care for the collective well-being of all South Africans. And my call would be that if we have true leadership in this country, then the presidency and the Ministry of Defense would adjust their response and ensure that they are communicating to the army that any acts of police brutality will not be acceptable and that there will be harsh circumstances against those who take such steps. I'm quite hopeful that if in the time that we have, as you see, this is a long-term game, that government brings in civil society, even in the conversations around police brutality, in the circumstances around livelihoods, as we've seen with the inclusion of precarious and casualized workers in the UIF TRS scheme. We have a chance to end this crisis in a much better position. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the very insightful reflections and keeping in touch with what's happening on the ground and how security forces are responding to the current lockdown and implementing the regulations. The first one is, how can civil society and organizations on the ground compensate for a flawed and limited government system? What best practices can be implemented to bypass a lack of government collaboration? Can I direct the question to you, Nomzamo?
I think what has happened already is that civil society has on its own established its own collaborations. I think that's really the first point of call. If government is not willing to work with civil society, the best thing to do is to go back as civil society to see what are the resources that we have outside of government and how do we use those resources to respond to the crisis? And secondly, I think there has been a lot of work being done around mapping what are community-driven initiatives, because I think that's where the most resources are sitting that are being ignored at this point. And I think if you merge those two systems, one, what is happening in communities currently, together what civil society is able to offer, we can then maybe leverage that with government. Some of these civil society organizations are supported by philanthropy, and using also the voice of philanthropy to bring government to the table. Those are the two things that I can think of right now.